My movie about colliding black holes is gonna be big. But the collision? It's wimpy. I mean, a chirp? Chirp ain't gonna generate blockbuster ticket sales. You're an engineer. Can't you, enhance it? You know, make the audiences really feel these cosmic monsters.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've got a sound archive here. Hey, listen on the headphones. Check this out.
I like it, but we need more, explosion action.
Okay, how about this?
This isn't just a Hollywood film. This needs to sell on the international market. Make it more, mayhem-y.
Why didn't you say so? Okay, there. Now I'll play it on the monitors.
Yeah, play it on the speakers. Sciency Stuff Productions presents Colliding Black Holes.
This is WHFR Dearborn. You are listening to The Magic of Radio. Step away.
Hi, and welcome to Foodies on the Fifth, the show about all things culinary with an emphasis on the HFC culinary program. The views and opinions expressed on Foodies on the Fifth are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio nor Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Hi, I'm your host, Lynn, and today we're discussing new and exciting things going on in the HFC culinary world with Chef Joe Cosenza. And Chef Cosenza, thank you so much for being here with Foodies on the Fifth. Try that one more time.
It's a pleasure to be back.
There we go. Thank you so much. Lots and lots and lots of stuff going on in the kitchen, and we've been watching lots and lots of progress all summer. So tell us about what's going on with this new remodel of the 5101 restaurant.
Well, it originally started with just being able to add some new equipment into the kitchen, but we were able to also do a whole bunch of stuff out front. So when you walk up, you'll see a new paint scheme, brand new doors. We remodeled all the cabinets so that we have walnut and granite cabinets. We have new carpeting, so that beautiful, crazy, what I like to call casino carpeting is gone. It was kind of like a kaleidoscope every time you looked at it.
It was
a little bit different every time I saw it. We are adding high top tables that also have walnut tops on there. We'll have high chairs for those tables as well. We're going to have a portable 6-foot bar, which is going to allow us to expand on our cocktail offerings. And the one big change is we now have a semi-open kitchen. And what that means is the wall that separated the kitchen and the dining room now has a fireproof glass window in it so that the guests can see the students cooking and working. And that also requires the removal of the salad bar.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of people that that are fearing this change, but it allows the students to get a little bit more creative with the salads that we do. We'll be able to stay on point with some of the themes that we do, as well as have just a traditional house salad that is something that we'll be able to offer as well. Mm-hmm. So, but like I said earlier, we've been nudging everyone towards the removal of the salad bar. So each semester for the last 2 years, we've had two menus where we've sent a plated salad to each guest. And so we've kind of gotten everybody a little bit ready for it. Maybe they didn't really know what was going on, but
subliminal salads.
That's right. We're there.
Well, everything's always great. And there were a couple things on the salad bar that I definitely enjoyed too. So
it's a lot of fun to make. It was a big challenge for a lot of the students. In fact, one of my production assistants was solely responsible for setting up the salad bar. And most days I just looked at him and said, you know what, just make it good. Mm-hmm. And he'd hand me things to taste and we'd adjust it and put it out. And they all did an amazing job with it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of issues with salad bars with, you know, sanitation and mm-hmm. food safety and things like that. Guests don't always use the utensils that are provided. But moving forward, I think the guests will really like a lot of the changes that we have.
And how many people have you seen under the sneeze guard as opposed to on top of the sneeze guard where they're supposed to
be? Too many to count.
I know. That's awful.
I'm guilty of it too. I do it as well. I want to get in close and see what's going on inside there. I get it. I do.
Oh my gosh. Well, there we'll look for the new offerings.
It's going to be exciting.
Yeah. How about soup? You want to talk about soup? Because you guys make amazing soups.
So soups, we've always done three different soups each week. And the more I've been able to talk to the guests and spend some time in the dining room, the more I've found that schedules prevent people from getting in certain days of the week. And what we decided to do is we're going to change that. And instead of doing three soups a week, we're going to pick one and still offer our French onion. But we're also going to have one soup all week long so that our guests that come in on Wednesday, if we do like dill pickle during our Polish week, we get a lot of guests that come in on Wednesday and they're, oh, well, you did dill pickle yesterday. Do you have any more? No, of course not. But so we're going to have it all week so people won't miss out on those soups.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds like a good plan. And as I said, your soups are always wonderful. Great.
Well,
great.
You know, the students do an amazing job, and that comes down to the level of instruction that they're getting from the chefs that are teaching those beginning classes and really pushing technique and skill. And they do an amazing job. And I can't get food into the dining room without those guys. And, and you know, they start everything off, and they've been amazing.
Right. Right. What kind of menus are you planning for the coming season?
So we will always have our static menu. That changed quite dramatically over the summer of 2016. We're going to keep that the same now. So we'll have our steak Rossini. We'll keep our chicken pepperad sandwich, which people seem to love. Then we'll start with Southern Italian the week of the 20th. Well, it's not really the week of, but the Wednesday, 20th September is when we open. So we'll start with Southern Italian there. We'll move into our steakhouse menu. We'll do Deep South. One of the things we do in the fall that's different from the winter is we'll feature a menu, Cuisine of the Midwest.
Okay.
And that will allow us to take advantage of our new rotisserie that we have in the kitchen. We have a solid fuel wood-burning rotisserie that also has a grill attachment to it. It's custom built, and it's amazing. It's beautiful. Can't wait to fire it up next week and, and see it go. We'll use that rotisserie primarily for our food truck. And our food truck is all about wellness, and we know that rotisserie cooking really helps keep things low fat. So we'll do most of our chicken for our chicken offerings on the rotisserie, but we'll have a lot of smoke and a lot of solid fuel stuff in the restaurant as well.
Okay. Excuse me. Desserts, anything special there?
Desserts, actually, Chef Chris and I are going to sit down tomorrow and run through menus and look at desserts, but we'll keep a lot of the idea with desserts is to do a chocolate, a fruit, a cream, and then something special.
Okay.
And so that way, you know, not everybody likes chocolate, not everybody likes fruit, not everybody likes cream, so we try to keep a variety, which is crazy to me because I like all three. But what I think we'll start to see is a little bit more of a modern plating design. We'll start to see maybe some a little bit more aggressive flavor profiles,
okay.
I guess.
Translate.
We'll start to see a little bit less traditional stuff and a little bit of the things that are happening that are a little bit more modern. Maybe one of the ideas I have for the Midwest menu is to do like a corn ice cream.
Oh, I have never had that.
Oh, it's amazing.
The first time I had raw corn, I said, you can't serve corn raw. Oh, yeah, you can.
Yeah, you can. It's amazing.
Yeah, you can. It really is.
It's delicious. A friend of mine made a corn ice cream at one of the restaurants I worked at, and it tasted like Corn Pops, the cereal.
Okay.
And it was just
the
best
the creamy.
Ice cream. Yeah, the creamy and the cold. It just was one of the best ice creams I ever had.
Wow. Any kind of spice or anything that would go in that at all?
Not inside of it. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking, we'll see what we come up with.
Yeah.
But it's really, it'll be fun.
Yeah. And cream of corn is so good.
So good.
So, wow.
And we're in the middle of corn season.
Yeah.
Corn and tomatoes.
Yes. Yes. Speaking of.
Speaking of. Oh, what a segue, huh?
Tell us about that farm out there.
This is our third year, our second year of major production. We have a garden outside the department. Last year, we brought in close to 250 pounds of tomatoes that we used throughout the semester for sauces and salads and things like that. We're not as big this year on tomatoes, but we've already pulled in about 60 pounds.
Wow.
And so we're starting to produce tomato sauces. We have butternut squash that grew. So last year, we didn't plant melons, and we had melons grow. So one of the things that we do is we compost all of our vegetable trim, mm-hmm. and we use that compost to fertilize our ground. Well, last year in that compost, we had cantaloupe and honeydew melon mm-hmm. seeds inside the compost, and those grew, I mean, for lack of a better phrase, literally organically
yes.
out of the ground. And then the same thing happened this year with butternut squash. We did not plant butternut squash, but as you walk outside that first little area with those giant leaves,
yes.
that's all butternut squash that just happened to grow out of our compost. So we are organic, we're sustainable. Everything that we produce inside the kitchen, whether it's trim, is going into a compost bin. We're grinding it. We're adding it right back into the soil. So we're really excited about the farming program that we have right now.
Right. So we have squash. We have melons. We have tomatoes.
Squash, melons, tomatoes, collard green, mustard greens. We have a whole variety of herbs. Chef Chris and I are going to start planting microgreens this week, so they'll be ready in about a month mm-hmm. to show the students how to use those for garnish. That's kind of in trend right now. We've got basil, thyme, rosemary. So a lot of the things that we're going to be using in the kitchen for the next couple of weeks here, especially moving into the restaurant opening, will be harvested directly out of our farm. And so we are 30 feet away from the farm, so it's farm to table pretty quickly.
Yeah. And I must say that walking back in that area, everything looks so healthy.
Yeah, and that's attributed to the compost and the fertilization
exactly.
Methods we use. So there's no chemicals whatsoever in there. And Chef has been out there all summer long tending to the garden, both happily and unhappily. But the results are there. The students have been out there helping as well. We get them involved in the whole process. So they see things go from seed to plate. Mm-hmm. And that's really one of the advantages of our program as well, is just being able to grow the food, harvest the food, cook the food, taste it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these programs just don't have that ability.
Right.
So that's one of the things. And then our production environment is just incredible. Knowing that everything they're making is being used in one of our outlets or on the bake sale is just, they're trained the right way. They're mm-hmm. they're taught how to work as opposed to, well, how to make a recipe.
Yeah, exactly. I do a recipe on No Boys Allowed at 1 o'clock, and I always say a recipe is just a guide. Mm-hmm. Unless you're baking, you have to be a little more precise with that, but it's a
yeah.
guide, and you make it to taste, and you make it yours.
Well, I told my students this morning, because this group of students, their first class was this morning, I told them, I said, look, anybody can take a recipe and follow it. I said, but a recipe doesn't have any soul. And it's just a piece of paper, and you bring the soul to the dish. Mm-hmm. Your final touch, your taste, you know, your care and your concern and your emotion goes into the food, mm-hmm. and that's what brings soul to the food.
Exactly. Wow. Anything happening other than the rotisserie? Is there anything happening menu-wise that we've never seen before in 5101?
No, you know, we've been doing so much lately. You know, we've been practicing sous vide a little bit with one of our chicken dishes on our static menu. We do have a hearth oven. I have to be really careful how I say that. It's a
yes,
hearth oven. It looks like a giant pizza oven, but we'll be able to do hearth breads, and we will be able to do Neapolitan style pizzas in it.
Okay.
Whether or not we do them right away, we'll see. But mm-hmm. yeah, we'll start to see a little bit more flatbread kind of things. Some pizzas will come out of there soon. It really comes down to our imaginations and what we're only limited by what we think we can do. And,
right.
and there's a lot out there that we can do. Right. So it's a very exciting time to be on the program. the things that we're going to do, the ideas that we have, the way we're looking at steps of service, our guests are going to have an entirely different feel. It's really exciting because I feel like every semester I feel like I'm opening a restaurant, but this semester I feel like I'm opening a brand new restaurant.
Wonderful. And you mentioned earlier about the counter that's going to give you a little more bar service capability. Are you moving away from just beer and wine into a full bar, or?
Eventually, we'll offer a couple of cocktails. So what we've done the last couple of semesters during our scholarship dinners, we've offered two different cocktails at each one. We've had beer and wine service, mm-hmm. and then we've tailored two cocktails for each one. So the fall of 2016, we did an old fashioned and our version of the last word, which is a drink that was actually made famous here in Detroit at the Athletic Club during Prohibition. And so we did those. Then we did another gin and another whiskey drink this past spring. So as we start to look at our cocktails, we'll start to work with some of the people in the industry that are here that are tied to the program itself and okay. start to develop and design a small, very focused cocktail program, okay. which will be exciting.
I can't say I've ever heard of a last word before. What's in that?
It's gin, lime juice, a little bit of egg white, and simple syrup.
Interesting.
It's excellent.
And then blended, of course.
Yeah, so shaking in a mixer, froth. So you get the froth, and the egg white kind of mellows out the acidity from the lime and the gin, and it's just a great drink. Right. It's really crisp and clean. It's great in the summer.
Interesting, too. So that's, again, adding more creativity to the whole program.
A little bit of creativity. We like to try to take on as much history from Detroit and the food scene. I know that everybody's so excited about the food scene here in Detroit, and a lot of people are, it's brand new. It's been around forever.
Yep.
It's been here for a long time. Yep. People just are starting to take notice, and right. the things that are going on are incredible, and we're just happy to be a part of it.
You are now offering a four-year program.
Yes.
And this past May, we actually had four people graduate.
We did. It's very exciting.
Very exciting.
We've taken a little bit of history. Four graduates from our bachelor degree program, the first four ever. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to graduate a few more than that this May.
Okay.
And they are doing hands-on as well as book work. So they're working really, really hard.
Okay. And do we know anything about what happened to the four graduates?
One of them we brought on staff. Actually, two of them are on staff currently.
Okay.
And then the other two have gone on into the industry. I believe one is working for Henry Ford Hospital, and the other one I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Those are, I'm familiar with the Henry Ford culinary area, and amazing. It's a big operation.
They've changed a lot, and, you know, hospitals are starting to view patients as guests, mm-hmm. and they're starting to tailor the way they do food service, similar to the way hotels do room service, which makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how things shake out. There's been a lot going on, so a lot of demand for trained culinary professionals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. With regards to ground one, level one, mm-hmm. How many students have come in to start their four-year program this year?
Well, what we do is we don't allow students to come right in straight off the bat and say, I'm going to be in the bachelor degree program.
Right.
We want students who we know are committed to getting their education. So they have to finish their first year of the culinary program before they can change their major to the bachelor degree.
Okay.
And I believe right now we're close to 40 students that have declared their major as a bachelor.
Wow, wonderful.
It's incredible.
Wonderful. And then we've talked a lot about the cooking and the creativity and mm-hmm. the experimenting and all that, but there's the front of the house, too, that they have to learn.
They do. So another advantage to our program is we teach all three facets of it, the front of the house, the back of the house, and the management side of it. So when they leave the kitchen as a cook from the restaurant perspective, so they leave my class and they go on to their next semester, they actually turn around and they work as servers inside the dining room, and that's where they learn how to manage the floor, work with guests, educate guests, because part of our role as culinarians is to actually educate our guests and let them know, you know, what different preparations are, if there's an ingredient on a dish that the guest may not be familiar with, what it is. And then also try to, you know, kind of nudge them in a direction to try something that they wouldn't normally try. That's big for us, you know, getting guests to kind of step out of their comfort zone and maybe try swordfish when they've never had it before.
Right.
Or to try something other than chicken. We have a lot of people that are like, and then that's great, but we want to make sure that we're educating too. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, they're learning how to manage guest checks, taking and receiving money, making sure that they're giving the proper change. But then also the big one for me is making sure that they understand how to cash out a server so that the server's getting the right amount of money back in the form of tips. And all of our tips go straight to a scholarship fund, mm-hmm. but the math and the management of it is all the same. Mm-hmm. And then making sure that the POS system and the revenue that's generated that day matches up with the actual cash and the credit card receipts that we have. So need to learn that, or else they'll hire a manager who may not be on the up and up. And if you don't know it, you won't know to check.
Now, a lot of people coming into this program, I would think, are probably not familiar with some of the, let's call it, exotic food offerings that you're trying and doing back there. Mm-hmm. Are the students required, and I'm using air quotes, which you can't see on air, are they required to actually try some of these foods?
Well, I have a rule in my class, and my rule is, you want to be a chef, you have to taste food. And so I require them to taste everything unless they have an allergy. And the rule is kind of similar to the rule I have with my kids. You have to taste everything twice. So you have to take that first bite, and that first bite is usually with the clenched eyes and you're barely touching it with your tongue, and then you kind of go, ew, 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 right? The second time is when you realize that it doesn't actually taste that bad, and you can actually taste it and critically think about mm-hmm. it. So, mm-hmm. yeah, they have to try everything. I personally can't stand goat cheese, but I eat it.
Okay.
You know, especially when it's in a dish that I know it makes sense in. So I don't do well with sour and bitter, and my least favorite taste of all of them, but I eat it when I have to.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm curious about that corn ice cream.
We'll see.
If you need a taster, I'm...
we'll see if it comes about. I have a lot of visions of grandeur every once in a while with food, and then I start playing around. I'm like, wait a minute, this didn't work the way I thought it would. But that's okay, because then we can go back to the drawing board and mm-hmm. try again and try again, and eventually we get to where we want to be.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. What do you do with all those herbs? The produce I can see, you know, tomatoes are going into the sauces, and squash you can parboil or mm-hmm. roast or what have you, and freeze it. What about the herbs? Are you drying the herbs?
Some of the herbs we're drying. Most of them we're using right away.
Oh, okay.
So basil we harvested and we made a really nice pesto out of. The thyme will last quite a while, so we have some time on the thyme. Very funny. The rosemary will last quite a while, so we'll start to infuse butters with some of the herbs. We'll have some herb infused butters, we'll have some oils, and we'll find other ways to preserve it so that we can use it throughout the semester.
That is so exciting. Mm-hmm. And do you have any idea of what kind of money you're saving for the program by doing this?
No, I don't have numbers specifically. I do know that some of the steps we've taken, we've been, a lot of people in the administration are very happy with how much money we're saving. You know, and being able to incorporate new learning objectives that go above and beyond things that we've already established.
Right.
It's an incredible thing.
You have crops that planted themselves. I mean, it doesn't get any better.
We have crops
that
planted themselves. We've incorporated CryoVac into our program so that we're able to seal without any air inside bags, so that when we do freeze product, mm-hmm. It's lasting a lot longer than it would. We're not throwing anything away.
Excellent. Excellent.
It's incredible to see just the whole process.
Yeah. Well, I noticed with carryouts or leftovers, you have paper boxes rather than styrofoam.
And they are biodegradable paper boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're we're in the right, we're going in the right direction there too.
Dearborn just got a new trash service, and one of the things that they said was absolutely no styrofoam, and so many places had styrofoam. And our prior service, we were able to use the like carry out boxes and that sort of thing. As long as they had the number on it, they could go. And she said, no, when I called, no, we can't take any styrofoam at all because we don't have a place to get rid of it. So another reason why we shouldn't have styrofoam.
Yeah, well, I'm just glad that they're picking up the recycling every week now. Because my recycling bin was overflowing.
With glass and
it was a bad scene.
Oh man. And you have some exciting things coming up too.
We do. So talking about being a part of the culinary scene here in Detroit, we've started to expand into some big events. The last 2 years we've been fortunate enough to work with the Eastern Market Organization and helping prepare the food for their gala. Their big fundraiser for the year. Last year, we worked with the chef from Selden Standard, Andy Halliday, and this year we'll be working with the chef from Grey Ghost in preparing and presenting the menu and then producing all the food for the gala on October 13th, which is really exciting. It's great for the students because they get to work with some of the industry chefs. They get to see how they work, and they get to realize that the things that we're teaching them are the actual skills that they're required to have when they go out into the industry, because they see these chefs doing those exact same things. So that's October 13th. It's Friday the 13th. So hopefully all the evil spirits will stay away and the food will be amazing and everybody will be really, really happy with that. The other big thing that we have going on this year is September 16th. We'll be down at Campus Martius for the Free Press Food and Wine Experience. And there's going to be about 40 different restaurants down there. Some good friends of mine will be there, and we'll be serving one dish. Everybody will be serving, you know, a couple of bites of one dish. We're going to do a buttermilk braised pork shoulder with a little bit of a cherry mostarda and some farro, which I'm really excited about. And there will be a couple of celebrity chefs down there. Graham Elliott, who everybody's seen on TV, I'm sure, the guy with the white glasses and all the tattoos. And Martha Stewart will be there. And we are fortunate enough to be hosting her team on campus to use our facilities for their prep work. And we'll have two students working with them during her cooking demonstration on that Saturday.
Wow. And do we expect to see Martha?
Don't know. We'll see. I know she'll be there on Saturday for the event. Whether or not she stops on campus, I don't know. I think it would be very exciting for the students, but we'll see.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a little break and be right back after this music.
Thank you.
And we are back. You are listening to Foodies on the Fifth, the show about all things culinary with an emphasis on the HFC culinary program. And Foodies on the Fifth only occurs 4 times per year, and the months are never where you think they're going to be. just as an FYI, the next Foodies on the Fifth is actually going to be on October 31st, so it's on Halloween.
All right.
And so you have an event on the Friday the 13th, yep. And Foodies on the Fifth, yeah, on
well,
the 31st.
I should be good to go on the 13th. I was born on Friday the 13th.
So there you go.
You should be fine. but I am curious about one thing. The name of the show, Foodies on the Fifth. What is the fifth? Is it because we're at 5101 Evergreen?
No, it's the fifth Tuesday of the month. And it only happens 4 times per year. Oh. So the other talk shows are every month. Mm-hmm. And this one is sporadically scattered throughout 4 times per year. Yeah.
All right. I got you. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
there you go. And Chocolat, the music, the theme music, just love the music from Chocolat.
Oh, man, it reminds me of the movie Ratatouille.
Okay. Yeah. Which is a phenomenal dish. You should make that.
Well, we have. We've done it on a couple of different semesters. We usually do it during our Country French Week. And we've done it a couple of different ways. We did it as a gratin once. And then I got cute. And I researched the movie, and I found the actual recipe and the actual technique of the way they did it in the movie.
Oh, okay.
And so I printed it out. I handed it to Chef Gockenbach, and I said, this is how I want to do this. And he looked at me and said, are you serious? I was like, yeah, let's do it just like the movie.
Let's talk about it. And can we talk about it?
Sure. It's now is probably the best time to actually talk about it, too, because of all the ingredients
right.
in it that are in season right now. So it's zucchini and yellow squash and tomatoes and onions and eggplant and lots of thyme and red bell peppers, yellow bell peppers. And there's a couple of different ways, and everybody has their own way of making it. But the way I was taught how to do it was to cook everything separately,
mm-hmm.
and then combine everything with a little bit of tomato product, usually a very classic tomato sauce with lots of thyme in it, and then bring everything together that way. In the movie, what they did was they made almost like a pepper and tomato and onion compote, where they slowly cooked all the peppers and the tomatoes down and made this beautiful sauce. And then they laid it down flat on the pan, and then they sliced the eggplant, the zucchini and squash on a mandolin,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and then feathered it around in a circle in the pan, and then put a little piece of parchment on there, and then baked it. And then they plated it with the tomato sauce around the plate and the chives sticking up. And then they showed the critic who the actual chef was. And it was a great movie. You know, the thing I liked most about it was at the end when he takes the bite of the ratatouille. And it takes him right back to being a child and eating that dish as a child.
Ah.
And, you know, we talk a lot about that in class about, you know, if you have memories of certain foods, does it make the food taste better? As long as they're good memories,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the students, you know, they kind of shake their head, yeah, I think so. And then we talk a lot about, you know, when guests walk into your restaurant, they say, oh, you know, my grandmother made the best gnocchi. I can't wait to try yours. And you just look at them and you go, oh, no, I'm toast. And I am, because that guest is never going to have the same emotional connection to my food the way she has with her grandmother's food. And that's really a big challenge. And, you know, people walk in the restaurant with certain expectations. Is it going to be the same as my grandmother's? And no, it's not, because of that emotional connection and because of those memories you have of hanging out with grandma and grandpa. I know for me, there are certain dishes that I just will always remind me of my grandfather, and standing in the kitchen with my grandparents and making gnocchi and being too lazy to roll the gnocchi on the board or on the fork and getting smacked on the wrist by my grandmother because I wouldn't do it. And, you know, we have those emotional connections, and food is amazing, and being able to bring people back to being a kid or being, you know, a young adult or just in a specific place at a specific time.
Right. So, right.
We try to recreate those moments, but we don't have the same emotional connection.
Of course. But.
But.
If it's good food.
It should prevail.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we incorporate things. We use mostly traditional techniques in all of our cooking in the restaurant. So we teach the students how to properly saute, how to properly grill, how to properly braise. And braising is probably the hardest one. And most of us have had, you know, some braised meat, whether it's a beef stew or a pot roast, and you take a bite of that meat and it's just dry. And you think to yourself, well, how could you take a piece of meat and cook it in liquid for multiple hours on end and dry it out? And it really all comes down to the technique and the way in which that person who's cooking it cooks it. And so, you know, braising is a technique, as like any cooking. And what we do is we sear the meat and get a nice caramelization on there, and then we cook our vegetables and cook them down. And we'll add tomato paste if we're going in that direction. And then we'll deglaze the pan with a little bit of wine for a little bit of acid, and you know, get all that fond that the meat, if there's anything left after the vegetables cook, scrape all that up and reduce that down. And then the trick and the hardest part of this, and this is the part where people kind of miss, is they'll put the liquid, the stock, into the pan, and then they'll add the meat right away. And that cold stock, bring that liquid up to a simmer before we put it in. What I tell my students is bring it up to a boil, cut it down to a simmer, and let it simmer for like 5 minutes, and then add the meat in. And what will happen is we will have this beautiful, juicy meat that we expect to have in a braise. And of course, you know, you always get the doubters in class. And I had one student, no way, that's not it. And I said, okay. So she went home that night, apparently. The next day she comes in class. She says, Chef, I made beef stew last night. And I got to tell you, I was waiting for her to just drop this huge bomb. She says, it was the best beef stew I ever had. I followed your technique and you were right. I was like, oh. So when we're teaching, we're not just teaching recipes. And like I said before, a recipe doesn't have a soul, but what's most important is the technique and being able to draw out, you know, different complexities of flavor within the meat or within the vegetables. And that all comes down to how long we're cooking things and how much we're caramelizing things. My grandfather made this dish, and according to my family, it's called Genoese. And I don't know if it's right or not, but what I know was it was a roast beef, and he would sear the meat, and then he would take mirepoix, carrots, celery, and onions, and he would cook that down. He'd small dice it and cook it down, and they would add the meat back to the Dutch oven, cover it with a lid, cook it till it was medium rare, take the meat out. He would cook penne or some sort of short tubular pasta, and we would take the drippings from the beef and the mirepoix, and that would be the sauce for the pasta, and he would slice the beef. And it was amazing. It was the best thing. And every time he came to visit, he always asked, what do you want me to cook for you? And I always say the same things. I want that. I want Genoese. Okay. So after he passed, we were going through some of his stuff, and he was 101. He was,
Wow.
Yeah, he lived a super long life and had some amazing stories to tell about being in the Bronx in the 30s and the 20s and the 40s and who he cooked for and people that he met. And so my aunt, she loves to cook. So she found a recipe of his. And she's like, oh, look at this. And I said, oh, I guess I should tell you something. I have Grandpa's Genoese recipe written in his handwriting. She kind of got mad at me because I had it this whole time. So I handed it to her. I was like, well, here you go. You can have it. And my dad looked at her. I said, you know what? You should make that. And she said, okay. And she made it. And my dad and his brother and all of us were sitting at the table. And we all started eating it. And I could see the look on my uncle and my dad's face. And I was like, what's going on? And they turned around and they're like, it's not the same. And there were just things that he knew about the length of time to cook the vegetables and how long to cook them for that just changed the complexity of flavor and brought out some of that soul in that recipe. Mm-hmm. And then she and I kind of worked on it together, and we got it to where it was really close. So, but, you know, those techniques we teach because they work. And without them, we just are following a recipe. You know, if the recipe says a teaspoon of salt and we don't taste it, we're not sure whether or not that's enough salt, because salt, what it does is it opens up our taste buds and allows us to taste food. Without it, we can't taste anything. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of one of the major flaws of the human body, I think. You know, food should just be really good, right? Especially when it comes right off the vine. But it's not, and we need salt. And the ability to use salt is a skill. It's not just, you know, inherent in somebody's, oh, I should know how much salt to use. So what we do, what we teach is taste, season, taste. And we add a little bit of salt at a time, and we keep tasting until we know that we can taste the complexity of flavor in the dish, but we're not tasting salt itself, you know? And then,
right.
And that's a trick, and it's hard because once we get too much salt in there, we can't take it out. But we can always add just a little bit more, just a little bit more, just a little bit more. And it's interesting to watch the students when you start adding salt to a dish and you add some and you taste it and you add some, and they're like, whoa, you use a lot of salt. And I said, well, how much would you have used? And they said, none. And you smile, I said, okay, well, let's taste the two together. And when they taste it and then they see the difference in the taste itself, because we don't want them to just taste food and say, oh, I like it. You know, because, well, great, you like it, but why? You know, what is it about the dish that you like? And so we're trying to, in our charge as a college to teach critical thinking, we try to use a dish to allow them to critically think about what makes my tongue taste the food and make my brain go, hey, I like it. And although it's only a few inches from tongue to brain, it's like miles apart, because we need to understand balance and how we use acid and how we use sweetness and how we use fat to bring a dish together. And as we talk more and more, and as you see more and more of the dishes in the restaurant, they will become less and less about veg, starch, protein, sauce, and more about flavor profile and what flavors we can bring to the guest, and start to bring them a little bit more of an experience with food as opposed to just eating to sustain life. You know, because we know there's two different diners out there, and neither one is right, neither one is wrong. You know, but there are the people that are out there who just eat to sustain life. My brother's one of those guys. He doesn't care about flavors, he doesn't care about taste, he doesn't care about texture. All he knows is, well, food is a necessary thing that I have in order to live. And so give me food that I like.
Right.
And whether
right.
that's meat and potatoes or chicken and broccoli, he doesn't care.
Okay.
But then there's those guests out there who go to a restaurant for the experience, to experience flavors, to experience textures, to experience tastes, to experience, you know, whether it's something visual, you know, like some of the things that they're doing in some of these avant-garde restaurants now with the gases and the airs and the fake caviar and all these modernist techniques that we're starting to see come out. So there's those diners too. So we want to be able to achieve kind of appealing to both diners in the restaurant. Now, that doesn't mean with every single menu that we're going to be able to do that. You know, things like our Deep South menu, right? That's just hardcore Southern food.
Okay.
And there's no way of getting around it. You know, we're going to do mashed potatoes, we're going to do succotash, we're going to do country fried chicken. And those are things that, well, we could probably plate a little bit of it differently and maybe present some of the flavors, but who wants that? Everybody wants Southern food. They want just hardcore Southern
food.
But when we get into menus like our contemporary French and our Northern Italian, that's when we can start to visualize some of these more modernistic approaches to cooking. And one of the things that we've incorporated on a daily basis is sous vide into our menu.
Okay.
And sous vide means under vacuum. And what that means is, what we've done is we're taking a piece of food, we're sealing it in a vacuum sealed bag, whether it has some marinade in it or salt and olive oil, herbs, garlic, and then we're cooking it at low temperatures. And because we've sealed that bag with no oxygen in it, it allows us to be able to cook at lower temperatures than we traditionally would. Now, we know that a traditional braise, everything is really about the sauce, right?
Mm-hmm.
We take
right.
that liquid, we strain it, and then we reduce it down, or we thicken it with a little bit of flour or a little bit of cornstarch and make this beautiful sauce for our braise. And
right.
really that braise is about that sauce. You know, we've got that beautiful protein, but if you cook a piece of beef at 200 degrees for 14 hours, the majority of the flavor of that beef is going to go into the sauce. And that's why we're bringing that sauce back to the dish. Fat in beef melt at 174 degrees Fahrenheit. So at 200 degrees, we're already melting the fat into the sauce. Mm-hmm. But with sous vide, because we can cook under those temperatures that are where fat melts and where flavor starts to come out, we're actually starting to turn braises into being about the actual meat itself. So for example, we did a Korean-style short rib on one of our scholarship dinner menus a couple semesters ago. And so we marinated in a Korean-style sauce. We used a little bit of soy and apple cider, lots of sugar, lots of ginger. And we took that short rib and we put it in the bag with that marinade and we sealed it. And then we cooked it at 45 degrees Celsius, which is about 145 degrees Fahrenheit. So much, much lower than the temperature that beef fat melts. And we cooked it for 48 hours. And what we got from that was this sliceable, it held its shape, sliceable, unbelievably tender, beautiful texture. And when we sliced into that short rib, what you saw was the lines of fat still running through the muscle, and this beautiful, almost looked like medium, perfectly cooked piece of beef. And we didn't need to add, you know, gobs and gobs of sauce to it because the marinade, because it sat in that marinade for so long, right, it was already flavored with that Korean style marinade. So
how many hours?
We did it for 48. And, you know, it didn't take us much to prep. We, you know, got all of our marinades together, prepped everything, dropped it in. And what sous vide allows us to do is more precisely cook. You know, we're not the there's other step, traditional steps to that. So with our chicken dish on our static menu, we call it chicken and grits. And what it is, it's an actual half chicken. And we take the leg and thigh. So when the students go into the kitchen tomorrow, they're going to butcher chickens. That's their first task. And so we'll remove the breasts, we'll keep the skin on, and then we always keep the first bone on the wing on the breast. That's called an airline breast. And that's the way the airlines served it. There's a couple of different stories I've heard. One is it's the way the airlines traditionally used to serve a chicken breast, and then the other is because it's still got part of the wing, it flies. And so, but we'll take that, and we'll take that breast, we'll keep the skin on it, and we'll put it inside a Krawack bag with an herbed butter. We use garlic, rosemary, and thyme, and we'll make brown butter. So we'll brown the milk fat solids, and then we'll put that butter, once we cool it down a little bit, into the bag with the chicken. We'll season it with two parts salt, one part sugar seasoning. And that just allows it to just stay moist and stay fresh. And seal the bag. We'll poach that at 145 degrees Fahrenheit. Chicken is perfectly cooked. Then we finish it in a saute pan on the skin side so we get crispy skin. So we're still bringing it up to 165 degrees.
Yeah.
And removing any chance of bacteria to grow. So we're bringing it up to 165 degrees, getting beautiful crispy skin. The leg, what we do with that is we bone out the leg and thigh and make it boneless. We keep the skin on that. We take some of the trim from all the white meat of the chicken and we make a mousseline. And a mousseline is a very refined farce or a force meat where we take cream, eggs, and white meat chicken, blend it together. We run that through a tommy or a sifter so that we get all the chunks and all the texture out of it so it's perfectly, beautifully silky. We add a little bit of spinach to that, and then we wrap that, and we poach that as well. And then what we'll do is we'll make that crispy skinned on the outside too, and then we'll slice that. And so the guest is getting half a chicken, but it's presented in a way that it doesn't look like this gigantic half chicken.
Right.
The accoutrement that goes with that, we do a white cheddar grit cake. So we'll make grits with lots of white cheddar cheese, and then we mold that and we cut it into little rectangles, and then we sear the outside of it so it's nice and crispy, and then it's gooey and cheesy in the center. And then we do a mixture of oyster and button mushrooms and a little bit of asparagus that we glaze, and then it gets a roasted chicken jus. So there's a lot of technique that the students are learning just in that one dish. They're working with grains, they're working with sous vide, they're traditionally sauteing. We're making natural reductions in the sauces on our static menu chicken and our static menu steak dish. And that's important because we're removing starch from those two sauces. And when we remove starch, we remove calories. So instead of doing a traditional gloss de viande, or I'm sorry, not gloss de viande, but a demi-glace, where we're taking veal stock and reducing it and then thickening it with a roux, which is butter and flour, two of the things that all of a sudden people are afraid to eat, which make things delicious. We take those two things and we remove them, and then we're naturally reducing the sauce. So what's thickening the sauce is gelatin, that natural gelatin from the bones when we made the original stock. So it helps to remove some of those extra calories out of that sauce. And it allows us to have a little bit more complexity of flavor too, because we're reducing it. And if we've got really good herbs and really good veg and really good beef bones, when we make a beautiful stock, we're going to make an even better sauce.
Yes. Yeah.
So technique is king in that kitchen, and we push them hard and they keep going. You know, I love tomorrow because it's the first day in the kitchen, and you know, you see all the cocky faces and they're like, I'm ready to go, chef. And then they get in and they get a little bit nervous. And then by mid-semester, you're just turning around and asking if everybody's okay. And they're like, we got it, chef, get out of the way. You know, and I love getting pushed out of the way.
Wonderful.
Because I know that they're doing a great job, and they're confident. And the growth rate of our students from week one to week 16 is incredible.
Yes. Yeah. Tell me about these bags. Are these plastic or
they are
parchment?
Plastic. Okay. No, they're plastic bags. So what we do is we seal them in a cryovac, and what happens is they pull all the oxygen out of the bag, and seals it hermetically, and they can go right into water. So we're never cooking anything over 200 degrees. Mm-hmm. So the plastic won't melt.
Right.
And because it's in water, there's no actual metallic or any kind of heat touching it other than liquid. So they'll be able to float. In fact, a lot of the home sous vide instructions will tell you that you can use Ziploc bags. Mm-hmm. And you just, instead of allowing the zipper to go under the water, you just kind of clip it to the side of whatever container you have your immersion circulator in. And the cool thing about it is with the immersion circulator, that's the machine that's using to heat the water. Those were originally used for pharmaceutical companies to make their drugs.
Okay.
And that requires very specific temperatures. Mm-hmm. The cool thing about using one of those in the kitchen is we can maintain a very specific temperature. So we can put our chicken into the circulator water and hold it at the exact temperature we want it to hold for an extended period of time, because we know that the temperature surrounding that piece of chicken will never go above, say, 165 degrees. So there's less likelihood for us to overcook the chicken and dry it out. The other nice thing about it is we can just dump that chicken right back into ice, cool it down, and then reuse it the next day for service. And that's not something we can do. We've all had, you know, chicken that's been cooked and then cooled, and then we reheat it the next day, and we're like, oh.
Sort of like chicken sawdust.
Yeah, yeah, sort of like chicken sawdust. Yeah. So it allows us to reuse product a lot more. Again, goes back to food cost and saving money and making sure that we're getting everything we can out of everything that we have in the kitchen.
Interesting.
You know, although we are a learning environment, we are still held accountable for food cost. If we weren't practicing it, then we wouldn't be teaching what we're supposed to teach. So the students need to see us practicing it as well.
Okay. So we have just a few minutes left. We have the restaurant opening soon.
The restaurant opens Wednesday, the 20th of September.
Right.
So between now and then, we'll be training our students on all the techniques that they need to learn. We will be preparing most of our proteins. So we, like I said, we'll start butchering chickens tomorrow. We have our pork loins in. We have our beef in. One of the special things I think about our restaurant is that all of our meat is halal. So obviously with the exception of the pork. So we are making sure that we are using halal bones. We're making sure that we're following the right things so that we can say, yes, we're 100% halal. The other cool thing is we bring in our beef 28 days ahead of when we're going to use it so that we are wet aging all of our beef 28 days. And okay. That just brings complexity of flavor. So there's two ways we can age. We can dry age and we can wet age. Unfortunately, we don't have the space or the technology on campus to dry age. So we do a wet age and we do about a 28-day age on that. So
what does that mean briefly?
So what it means is we actually use good bacteria to kind of bring complexity of flavor to the meat. Mm-hmm. So if you were to walk into a dry aging room, what you would see is beef sitting on a rack in a room that is humidity and temperature controlled. And you would see this beef sitting on the shelves and it would literally look like there's mold growing on it. And they would just trim that right off and we would cook it just like we normally would, but okay. That good, it's actually good bacteria.
Right.
And that bacteria, what it's doing is it's reacting with the enzymes in the beef and it's giving a little bit of complexity of flavor to it. So it's making it taste a little bit more funky, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on the radio, right? So we can do that with beef. We can't do it with chicken. Chicken will just turn green and kind of go by the wayside. So we do that here. We can do it either wet or dry. Dry, we're going to get more complexity of flavor. Mm-hmm. Wet aging is that we keep it in the cryovac, so the same similar bag that we use to do our sous vide.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sits in the bag in the cooler. And then when we take it out, it has a little bit of a funk smell to it, but there's nothing really there.
Okay.
And we just trim it down to the portions that we need.
Yeah.
And seal it back up and go from there.
Joe's looking at my face as he's explaining this, and he's getting a little bit of an ooh factor there.
Well, the thing is we deal with a lot of bacteria in the kitchen, both good and bad, right?
Yeah, right.
We want to eliminate the bad.
Of course.
And we take major steps to eliminate bad by not cross-contaminating, by using sanitizer, making sure that food is held both hot and cold in the right temperatures, washing hands all the time. The other thing is we have good bacteria that we want to use to our
without
advantage.
It, we can't have great bread.
And the easiest one that everybody will identify with
and we
is
get
yeast.
That amazing
yeast
sourdough
is a bacteria
bread from
and
San
without
Francisco,
it, we can't have
right?
great bread.
That's natural yeast.
So
that was
when we
pulled
go
out of the air
from
the bacteria
that's
floating
around that we're living and
San
breathing.
Right.
And in doing that, that gives us, again, I say this all the time, complexity of flavor. And so when you take that bite, you get that sour and you get that salt and you get all of this little bit of sweetness. And we can get that from bacteria when we use it to our advantage.
Right.
Sour cream. So many people, we go to the store and we buy sour cream.
Well, we could use it to our advantage.
Right.
Sour cream. So many people, we go to the store and we buy sour cream. Well, we can make sour cream. And when we make it, and we do make it here, when we make it, what we do is we take cream and buttermilk and mix it together, and then we let it sit at room temperature for 3 days. Now, mm-hmm. everybody's always like, wait a minute, you're going to put cream in at room temperature for a couple of days? And I say, yeah. So, yeah. But it's not, and it's fine. What happens is the bacteria in the air reacts with the acid in the buttermilk, turns that cream from a liquid to a solid state, and we get this beautiful sour flavor. And we put it in the cooler, let it cool down to the right temperature, and you taste it, and you put that up against any sour cream on the market.
Oh,
and I guarantee you,
sure.
It has so much more flavor to it. It has so much complexity to
yeah.
it that you just don't ever want to go back. And I understand that we have to make sure that we're not using bacteria bad. And there are certainly things like making sour cream can go wrong. But as long as we know what we're doing and we're educated
right.
on some of these more modern techniques where we are playing with bacteria,
mm-hmm.
we can be really successful with the outcomes and we can make sure that food is tasting better than it ever has.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And for reservations, we should call the 5101 restaurant and
yep.
get on the list. We can do that anytime.
Anytime. Get on the list as soon as you can. We know with all the renovations and everything that we're doing, we're hoping to be super busy this year and we're excited to see everyone.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah,
it is gorgeous in there.
I can't believe how beautiful it is.
Okay. So it's 313-317-5101. Is
that correct?
Okay. Very good. And again, what are we starting with?
We're starting with Southern Italian, kind of from my roots. So
okay.
We're only open Wednesday and Thursday that week. Okay. So we'll be open Wednesday morning and Wednesday night, Thursday morning, Thursday night. And our hours are the same, 11:30 to 1 for lunch, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and 6 to 7:45 on Wednesdays and Thursdays for dinner. So hopefully we'll see a lot of people out and excited to taste all the things that we can do.
What's the soup?
I don't know yet. We haven't started talking about menus yet. We got menu meeting tomorrow.
Okay, very good. And Chef, thank you so much for being with us here today on Foodies on the Fifth. And thank you all for listening to Foodies on the Fifth, the show about all things culinary with an emphasis on Henry Ford's culinary program. Views and opinions expressed on Foodies on the Fifth are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio nor Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Thank you.